having an audience be able to relate to the person who's telling their story before they're given the opportunity to make a judgment about that story and how that person has dealt with it. It's tough. It's nuanced. It's interesting, and it consistently worries me.
Welcome to Contributing Factors, Season 1, Episode 6. I'm Caroline Leland, your host on the behalf of Health Further. In this episode, my colleague David and I come together to reflect on what we heard and learned in the first 5 episodes of the series. In the middle of the episode, you'll hear part of a reflective conversation between David and our colleague Matt, and then David and I will discuss listener feedback and then briefly share our plans for Contributing Factors Season 2. Please remember that nothing in this series can be taken as medical advice. If you need help, seek a medical professional or find a trusted friend to help you do that. Chapter 18, Looking Back. Episode 1 was the introduction where we introduced ourselves and the concept of depression. And then in episode 2, we covered the clinical and biological background of depression. And then episode 3 covered social context. Episode 4 went over the healthcare system as a whole. And then in episode 5, we went over business and innovation surrounding depression. And now we're here at episode 6. And so for you, David, what stood out to you as we put this together?
I think the two really big things that struck me were one is the causes of depression and really our limited understanding of what that looks like. And then the other is just the whole policy situation around it. And I guess, like, starting with the policy thing, just in building this series, looking at how difficult it was for us to get answers from people on the insurance side, and then also on the policy side, it was really remarkable to me that everybody we asked either didn't know, didn't really have an understanding of what the policies were, or weren't able to really give a straight answer. And so, like with mental health parity and reimbursement and things like that, I was really kind of amazed that this is such a big deal, and yet nobody really knows what's going on, and everybody's kind of looking at each other and sort of pointing fingers. And so that was a big thing for me.
Right. It's I feel like a lot of the aspects of this topic in general are just kind of slippery. Like it is hard to get a hold of. How do you regulate mental health? Because it's hard enough to define it and understand it. So then how do you go about building policies to protect it? And right. And then anything that involves a lot of regulation is going to be hard to navigate, and healthcare in general involves a lot of regulation. So I think episode 4, when we went over policy and the system, that was the most intellectually challenging episode for me to put together in terms of trying to make sure that I portrayed things as comprehensively as possible without leaving any major gaps. And so when I asked people my questions, sometimes I wasn't even sure what to ask. And so I hope that we were able to at least show people the general situation, even if we weren't able to dive into a lot of details about it.
You made a comment on Slack that you felt like episode 4 was, it sort of was pointing out the problems without a whole lot of solutions. We try to be optimistic and forward thinking and looking at where things are headed, but sometimes just the reality is sometimes the problems are what we have. And I thought you did a good job of asking the right questions. I mean, sometimes again, you just can't, like, what are you going to do if somebody doesn't have an answer? They don't have an answer.
Right. Yeah. I think in that episode, I think I signed off a little bit too kind of glib, like, oh, there's other solutions. We don't have time to talk about them. But it really was more about not even knowing what they were, how to find them. What we could have said more explicitly in that episode was there aren't enough solutions. And that's part of why we're doing this series, is to help educate the general public on what all these different problems are, what they look like, and maybe start conversations that are likely to create or lead to solutions.
So I guess going on to the second part for me, the whole thing around the causes of depression. As we produced this, we kind of started off, I think, with an assumption about neurotransmitters and how they operate or don't operate appropriately in different mental health situations. And it was really interesting to me that as we move forward with production and talking to different people, there's a lot of stuff coming to light about just how uncertain we really are about the root causes. It really is becoming clear that there are a lot of ways to sort of get to depression.
It's almost like the more you learn about it, the less you understand it, or the more you realize it, that how little you know, that whole situation, where it's so hard for me to wrap my mind around this continuum of mental health to physical health and how it is a behavioral health disorder. Are you responsible for the decisions you make while you're depressed in terms of especially your health decisions? And it's not a straightforward disease. It's hard to look at it straight on. And there are a lot of people do have their own, depending on what perspective they're coming from, they might have their own definition, their own understanding. But then you ask someone else and they approach it from a different angle that explains it a totally different way. And then as someone who experiences depression, how do you just understand it for yourself? And guilt is a symptom of depression, but then it's also because you are experiencing something that's hard to see out externally. It feels like you need other things to validate it. And it's just all this together is so complex and messy that I agree with you that the idea of understanding causes is key or central to all of that.
Yeah. And what you just said there reminded me of a book that you pointed out to me, and I'm still working my way through it, but the book's called Lost Connections by Johann Hari. And when you were talking, it reminded me of what the author says at the beginning of the, or towards the beginning of the book, saying that grief often ends up being diagnosed as depression and people are put in sort of a depression treatment protocol. And I say that, you know, this maybe isn't appropriate because grief needs to be worked through in different ways and people need to be given time to grieve without actually being diagnosed as having a mental illness. There is so much complexity around how we deal with all of this. We've got a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, that overlap or distinction between grief and depression is especially interesting to me as I'm trying to understand my own personal experience with depressive symptoms. So my mom died when I was little, and I've been reading about how that kind of early childhood trauma can lead to a depression in adulthood. And that's very interesting to me because I wouldn't have thought that I would still be grieving someone who died 13 years ago. But then I read somewhere that that depression is separated from grief in a clinical realm by 6 months. So if it's within 6 months of the cause of grief, so say someone died, after 6 months, you've been shifted from the category of grief to the category of depression, which I think is almost hilarious because it's so arbitrary. But when you're in a clinical setting, you have to have consistent guidelines or definitions or categories to put people in order to be able to operate in a consistent way. It's so interesting to me that 6 months, that struck me as so funny. And people have talked to about it all think it's absurd. Anyone who I know who's experienced grief. But yeah, that's an especially, we didn't talk about that at all in the series about the idea of grief and how it overlaps or contributes to or is intermingled with depression and how hard it can be to tease those two concepts apart.
Yes. Okay. So I was going to ask you this later in the conversation, but since you brought it up, I want to hear, I want to hear more about your experience and what this process, what this series has done for you and your understanding of your life. Talk about that a little bit more, because I think that's really interesting.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I think I said this at the beginning about how I was excited to start the project, partly for a selfish reason, because I like to intellectualize my life and my problems. And so it was a great excuse to be able to dive into what I was experiencing personally from an intellectual perspective, from a professional perspective. And it really has it makes me more confident to feel like I know so much more about depression now, and makes me feel validated to, so actually someone brought up with me recently, why am I so careful to say depressive symptoms instead of saying that I've experienced depression? And it's because our culture has this obsession with categories, and I've never been diagnosed with anything specific, so I haven't put myself into a category. But all of my research from this series has given me confidence or validation that what I experience is real and significant. So for example, I heard somewhere that depression is likely to occur in someone's early 20s, especially when they're entering a major life transition. And that might seem obvious as I say it now, but when I started experiencing depression, which was shortly after college graduation, or not, again, depression, I don't know if that's the right word, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that that was a likely time for me to experience depression or depressive symptoms. So hearing that made me feel like, it just added another layer of I'm not weak or failing at something, that knowing that it was part of a broader pattern that's been identified somehow made me feel more comfortable with it. And all of this, again, is sort of like opening up new conversations about stigma and back to that whole thing about guilt. But yeah, it's been a really, really great experience for me, normalizing the experience of depression or depressive symptoms just in my own mind. So that has been, it's been fun. It's been, yeah, definitely a positive experience.
What about, I'm also curious to know what your thoughts are on the whole root causes, and root causes being one thing, but then especially the current treatment modalities for depression. And again, this goes back to the book I just mentioned and some of the other feedback we've received. But as somebody who relatively recently started taking SSRIs, was prescribed by a GP, like what's your take on that? What does that feel like for you? You know, as you're taking medications and you've talked to therapists and you're mm-hmm. learning all this different stuff about what might work and what might not. And then at the same time, you're dealing with your own experience and your own reality.
Yeah. So my personal understanding at this point is that, so I know that there are that everyone carries certain genetic predispositions to depression, that childhood trauma makes it more likely you'll experience it as an adult, that regardless of what actually causes it, there is a biological basis for it. And so for me, the SSRIs were like a quick fix. And I am a little bit nervous about, because I've read places about it might not be effective long term, or it might just be putting a Band-Aid on a bigger problem. So I have been trying to find a therapist, which is a whole other story about how hard that is to do. But
Yeah,
we
should talk about it on the record
for sure.
Too.
And for me, I'm gonna keep take. So I am the pills for me are working, and I'm really happy about that because it gives me the space, the emotional stability to be able to examine some of maybe the more root causes of what I'm experiencing. Like, am I still grieving something that a person that died 13 years ago? And so I've been attending these like grief dinners that help me process that. And, which is, I guess, therapeutic in a way. It's not officially therapy, but, and then in terms of major life transition, trying to work through how I have experienced my adjustment to life after college and being really intentional about working through those thoughts and feelings. And I've been doing that mostly on my own, but knowing that it's important for me to be able to understand those things and to act in ways that can maximize my personal happiness and satisfaction with life. And it's all, it gets kind of broad at that point where everyone should be doing these things. Everyone should be thinking about their life decisions and how it impacts their emotional well-being. And I exercise every day and I try to eat well and all these other things that are recommended to protect mental health as well as physical health, because they are so deeply intertwined. Understanding and knowing that there is a physiological basis and that my SSRIs address that physiological basis to give me the emotional stability to try to dive more into the environmental elements, the experiential and environmental elements of what might be causing my symptoms. That's how I've been approaching it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And it makes sense because, like we said about giving yourself, it gives you the room to deal with other things. You're not looking at this as just a one-off. You're going to take a pill and that's going to fix everything. It gives you the room to deal with everything.
Right. Because I think it's more than just my brain not processing serotonin properly. I think that's it's only a part of it, a part of what is happening in a bigger sense, in a broader sense.
Yeah. And it's no different than almost any other health issue. And we keep talking about this throughout the series about how mental health and physical health are distinct, but probably shouldn't be because they are so intertwined and the brain is part of the physical body. And so, you know, why are we looking at these things so differently? But, you know, if somebody is overweight and has high blood pressure, take blood pressure meds so that you can then be physically capable of getting out of the house and going for a walk. I mean, if you have such high blood pressure that you are going to be in trouble, if you, you know, get your heart rate up or whatever, then you can't go for a walk and then you can't lose weight. So start there and then start dealing with the other things that you can control in order, or at least deal with, so that you can then start to make some progress. We look at modern medicine as this one and done sort of deal. You have surgery, you take a pill, and then it's over with. But it's going back to the whole behavioral health component of this. We have to make behavior change. We have to make decisions. We have to change our habits. We have to quit smoking, quit drinking, eat better, sleep more, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's true for any health issue. So why would it be any different for mental health?
Right. I mean, I like the term holistic health. I know it has these hippie-dippy connotations, but that's how I try to approach my personal life is holistically thinking about, am I sleeping enough? Am I eating right? Am I exercising? There's all these things to think about. Am I personal relationships healthy? am I spending time with people who make me feel good? Like all these different things that you wouldn't always, like, it's funny to me that my relationship with my family might have almost a direct relationship to those SSRI pills that I take every morning, because both of them are contributing to my mental health. And the way my brain interprets all of these inputs, in a physiological way. I mean, cause everything is like emotions are chemicals. And so, which I like, I love that. I love that emotions are chemicals and brains are neurological. I mean, not brains, thoughts are neurological pathways. And we as humans have the power to shape those things, which I think is really cool. We aren't resigned or restricted to passively experiencing our own lives, that we can be proactive about taking steps to directly influence how we are experiencing our own lives.
Yeah. And that reminds me real quickly of something that Mary Carter said, in episode 2, when we were talking about the kind of the use of medication for depression. And she said that oftentimes she will recommend talk therapy before getting into meds, because it has been shown to be effective and it does help retrain those pathways, kind of rewire stuff, even separate from the chemical component of the medications. And so again, just an example of where these relational, emotional approaches, have a very strong physiological effect on us.
Right. Well, speaking of therapy, we can go back to that briefly. So I tell people to go to therapy all the time, and I'm a huge hypocrite because I actually have never been consistently to a therapist. And that's largely because of how much overwhelming effort it takes to find a therapist and find one who's a good fit. So that has just been my experience. And I think it surprised me how hard it was to find. And even after reporting on, oh yeah, there's a shortage of psychiatrists. But that has been something that I haven't yet, done to protect my own mental health. And I know it's something I need to do, but it's something that even as I consider myself a very proactive person and that I value my own health really highly, but that step has been one that I've encountered some barriers to over the last couple of years. So I think it's worth mentioning that.
Okay. And even in the last few weeks, you'd mentioned to me that you were struggling up in New York to get set up with someone, which was interesting to hear, because when you add that complexity to a situation like Lucero's, where she struggled just to get out of bed in the morning and then had to go find a therapist or whatever.
I can't even imagine. Really, it's just like, there's so many steps to find, you go on your insurance website, you put in your zip code, you get the results, and then it's just like calling provider after provider, and most of them don't answer. The ones that do answer aren't taking new patients. The ones that are taking new patients make you come in for a screening, and then when you get there, they look it up and they actually find out that, oh, after all, they don't take your insurance. And you're sitting there in the office, you've already done the paperwork, and you're like, okay, I can't keep doing this. And then you just take a break for another few weeks, and then maybe you go back to it and try those steps all over again. But it's a really daunting process, even for someone who has the motivation to do it, and the time and the resources. So to think about someone who's working a lot, or like you said, can't get out of bed, someone else would have to do it for them. There's really no way they could do all those steps.
Okay, so we're talking about like the challenges of getting therapy. And I guess this will also get us into some listener feedback or contributor feedback, since Dr. Lorenzo Luasis had some really interesting stuff about that whole thing.
Yes, definitely. So there are people out there who believe very firmly that depression is caused by environmental or experiential factors, and that the physiology of depression is caused by those things, that you experience something and it changes the way your brain operate, which is a valid perspective, that it goes from A to B in that way. And so therefore taking an SSRI or other antidepressant medication would be totally insufficient for addressing the root causes of your depression. And so with that in mind, that's why therapy is so important. And Dr. Lorenzo Luasis pointed this out in an email following up to our first episode, where he told us that he thought that we were espousing or endorsing the serotonin deficiency theory, which means that depression is caused by a deficiency of serotonin in your brain. And there are some studies that point towards that, but really there is no proof that a deficiency of serotonin can cause depression, or that it does cause depression. So he was just pointing out to us that we need to remember that serotonin, yes, is involved with depression, but that it's not necessarily the cause. And so I was really grateful that he pointed that out to us. And I wanted to make sure that our listeners knew that we acknowledged that nuance, that complexity there.
Yeah, for sure. And I'd encourage anyone to go to the episode page at healthfurthercom/contributing-factors, and then pull up episode 1. And Dr. Lorenzo Luasis posted those comments there, which is great. So you can kind of read through that. And I also want to say that I think we did hear some of that nuance. We didn't point it out, and I don't know that people, our contributors necessarily pointed it out explicitly, but looking back at his comments and then listening back to the episodes, that became kind of an implicit thing, that we were talking a lot about serotonin, but then you had all these different people talking about how environmental factors and, again, childhood trauma play into all of this. And, Mary Carter talking about how it's very difficult and not really useful to look at serotonin levels, and how different people respond or don't respond to different SSRIs. And then the fact that talk therapy works so well. So, this, even if it wasn't explicitly stated, this consensus that somewhere in there, it's a much more complex issue, and that, we can't just look at one or two neurotransmitters and call it a day.
Yeah, I think connected to this. So I have a friend who is earning a PhD in psychology, and she listened to episode 4, she pointed out to me that episode 4 was different from what she expected because she studies psychological treatments for depression instead of psychiatric, and that the systemic problems for psychology are different than the systemic problems for psychiatry. And I was kind of taken aback because I hadn't even considered those differences. And it just goes to show it's sort of one of the risks of covering a topic where you're not already an expert in the field, which is an advantage and a disadvantage in different ways. But I realized that episode 4, for example, which covered the systemic problems, focused on psychiatric context. So that is trained medical doctors who can prescribe medications, and that it didn't so much focus on the psychology perspective, which is more focused on psychotherapy without as much of an emphasis on medication. So I don't have a lot of information about how the psychology perspective is different in terms of systemic problems. But my friend who is in psychology said that she was interested in learning about the problems from a psychiatrist perspective. But I think it's important to point that out, that there is a difference there, that there is more to be said about systemic issues depending on what field you're in.
Cool. Yeah. Sort of a reminder that what we said at the beginning, where we tried to come at this from every angle that we possibly could, but we knew we weren't going to be comprehensive. And mm-hmm. I think we're being reminded of that.
As a quick follow-up to that, that same friend pointed out to me that in, I think, episode 1 and 2, I said the DSM stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychology, but it's actually the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And that was something that I thought I knew and clearly didn't. So, I want to address that also, that I'm not in the field. And so that was just like a small mistake that I had made in terms of verbiage, but it's important to be accurate with those kinds of things. Pause. This is host Caroline instead of conversationalist Caroline. Since we're on the topic of listener feedback, I'm taking you out of this conversation where David was talking to me, and I'm dropping you into a different conversation where David talks to our colleague Matt about his take on the series. Like me, Matt also has a personal connection to the topic. We went to him for feedback and insights throughout the process of producing this series. Here is 7 minutes of David's conversation with Matt, a segment we're calling Chapter 19. Her story is not his story.
Hey man, what's up?
Hey, what's good, dude?
This is gonna be fun.
Yeah, man, I'm stoked. I'm really stoked.
Actually, get to have like an maybe on the record conversation. Stoked.
Who knows?
Finally, get to have an on the record conversation for people to understand what we do.
Now, let's not get carried away.
With that, we should probably actually explain who you are. Bring you out from behind the curtain, Matt Faulkner, Director of Marketing at Health Further and our parent company, Briovation. And so if you've listened to the credits of Contributing Factors, you know that Matt Faulkner runs marketing for us, and this is Matt. He's had a lot of creative input in addition to just, just marketing. He's given some feedback, especially early on. Yeah, so appreciate your input and appreciate kind of your personal angle on all of this too, because it's added a lot. Hopefully some of it has come through in the actual story that we've told, or like the story arc that we've told with the episode, but it's been interesting for me, if nothing else, if nobody else, that just figuring out, kind of hearing your take on some of these issues. So it's been cool.
Yeah, man, it's been a lot of fun getting to talk about a subject near and dear to my heart. I mean, I guess at this point is a pretty good time for me to actually disclose that this topic is near and dear to my heart because I have suffered from depression for much of my life. My most recent major depressive episode was in Q4 of 2017. And then the one most recently before that was October of 2014. And then the one before that was August through December of 2010. So long history, long time listener, first time talker. So.
So what was your reaction when we told the team that we were going to be doing this series on depression? Because we did that without really knowing, you know, at the time what Caroline was dealing with. We didn't do it because of anybody.
Right. I mean, honestly, my first thought was, yeah, that's great. And then on a certain level, it was... On a certain level, the reaction was just like, of course we would do this because entrepreneurs experience mental health disorders at nearly twice the rate of the general population.
What are your thoughts about the story arc? And then kind of as a subset of that question, what, you know, what did we get right? What did we miss?
Yeah, I mean, so I think to answer the first question, definitely came at it from kind of two different perspectives. The first one being, you know, as we were starting to listen to the story, really wondering how our audience was going to react, you know, in the knowledge that so many of the people that we talk to are pretty entrenched in the healthcare system. And this series is not uncritical of that fact.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, from the... Because it's my job to worry about our audience, I definitely worried about our audience. As somebody who believes that people's mental health stories should be told, I think it's great as a result of that. As somebody who has suffered from depression and sometimes worries about the way that that gets characterized and the way that that gets perceived and talked about and thought about, it definitely did worry me, because Lucero's story is definitely not my story. This is not meant in any critical way because everybody deals with this in their own way. But her story is not my story. And my story is not her story, and our stories are not lots of people's stories. And complexity and nuance and relatability, I think, is really, really important as we tell these mental health stories. Having an audience be able to come in and relate to the person who's telling their story before they're given the opportunity to make a judgment about that story and how that person has dealt with it. It's tough. It's nuanced. It's interesting, and it consistently worries me. You know, I don't want people to look at me as somebody who's fragile and who can't handle life and who can't do great things because my brain happens to work a little bit differently.
Matt went on to talk more about the importance of not conflating an individual with their mental disorder, about the role of music in explaining and expressing depression, and about what he hopes the Contributing Factors series ultimately accomplishes. The full recording of that conversation can be heard as a bonus episode of Contributing Factors. Now I'm zooming you through space and time to put you back in that conversation between David and me that you were listening to in the first half of this episode. Here we are in the final chapter of the series, chapter 20, listener feedback and looking forward.
Cool. So what else from listeners? What caught your attention?
Of course I liked hearing the positive feedback as well. I don't know if it's too self-indulgent to go into that right now. What do you think?
Nah, throw some of it out there. We can show both sides.
Well, I liked when listeners pointed out to me that they liked the things that in my mind were already important things. So for example, someone said, I like how you explained why it's called contributing factors and how it's framed in the context of society and institutions. And that was the whole concept. So it made me really happy that someone grasped that, the whole concept, and liked it.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to come up with that title.
Exactly,
so
exactly.
Grateful they got it.
Exactly. An affirming kind of big picture compliment. And then let's see, someone else said they liked the "This is what depression feels like" segment with Ducero, and that it was good to include that in the first episode, which was just nice to hear that set the tone appropriately, because I think it's just so important for people to realize how crippling those severe symptoms can be, because that if you don't understand that, then none of the rest really makes sense in terms of debating how responsible someone, you know, how responsible is insurance companies for our insurance companies for insuring certain things and all of that when you don't understand how severe the disease can be. So I liked that piece of feedback. And then let's see, someone else said about episode one, the intro, they said, "I liked how you split it down between, quote, major depressive disorder and, quote, minor depression, and how you thought," and when they say you, they're referring to me personally, "how you thought you shouldn't get treatment because your symptoms weren't severe enough or that it was just a, quote, attitude problem." And that brought up a whole different topic, which this question of why is there a need to label a disease in order to feel it's valid? Someone else asked me that, because all this talk about terminology and categorizing depressive symptoms, which is just another thing to consider. Like, it's, I don't know if it's cultural or what, but that I thought was an interesting question, and I don't have necessarily an answer, but I'm glad that people are thinking about these things, thinking about whether these labels are useful and in what ways, and recognizing the limitations of putting labels on certain groupings of symptoms. And so those were some of the pieces of feedback that I appreciated the most. Do you have any thoughts on those, or was there anything there that stood out to you?
I think with that last point that you're making about the labels, I'm really sympathetic to that perspective of, like, why do we have to label something for it to be valid? And to me, we don't. We just have to label it so that we can talk about it and understand. And it goes back to what you're saying about, you know, grief versus depression being the cutoff is at 6 months. And so if you're still sad at, you know, 12:01 a.m. on day 181, now you've gone from being sad to being depressed. And it's like, okay, that's from an experiential standpoint, that's useless. And maybe that's the wrong place to put that cutoff. At the same time, like, how do we deal with these things if we can't talk about them in some way? And so that's a really interesting, larger sort of social and philosophical debate. And I don't have answers for that, but I am sympathetic to that, because we all struggle with having to assign some kind of language restrictions around whatever we're talking about, for stuff that isn't clear cut.
Yeah. There's definitely pros and cons to those kinds of labels. I think that naming something gives it power, in naming something gives it validity, allows you to look at it in a new way, as long as you're cognizant of those risks or dangers that it can still be, it can be useful as long as you recognize the limitations to those.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe it.
So I sent Lucero the preview podcast episode that we aired on our other podcast, The Future of Health, which David has been hosting for a while. And when I sent Lucero that episode, she responded with a long email that really meant a lot to me, because throughout this whole thing, it's been important to me not just to use her as a symbolic patient voice, but to respect her humanity and to honor her for sharing her experiences so vulnerably and so bravely. And so I'd like to end this season in her words with her final thoughts on the series. And then she wrote this just after she heard the preview episode, but I think the preview was a representative of the whole series. And so this is her response to that. She wrote, "I really loved the preview podcast. I found myself tearing up. I have never heard someone else talk about my experiences and about my story, so naturally I had a strong reaction. I just hope I did justice to all those who will listen. It's really hard to be a voice for something that affects so many people and in so many different ways. I am so glad you are doing this. I have been wanting to do a podcast on mental health for so long, but my life has been a series of ups and downs. I'm so glad I could make it happen in this way with you taking the reins. I'm sure you did a beautiful job. I'm so honored to have been able to cross paths with you and to have been able to be a part of this. Throughout my lifelong battle with depression, I have lived moments that I wouldn't wish on anyone. I have prayed for God to take my life out of just complete and utter desperation. And then I have later prayed for forgiveness for being so selfish and wanting to end my life when others are dealing with more grave issues. I read a statement in one of my old journals recently that is frightening, shocking, and a bit insensitive, but very representative of how I felt. I wrote, "I would rather have cancer than have these feelings of depression, because then at least I would have a reason for what I felt, and the pain would be physical and not just trapped within my own mind." I think that goes to show that what sufferers deal with is real. It can't be seen, but it is very real, and it should be given the same attention as other illnesses, because it is just as fatal. But at the end of the day, I came out of my worst bouts of depression a more driven and passionate person, because once you know what it is to have no will to live, you appreciate having the will to go on, and you become so much more passionate about the things you do, about the things that do make you happy, or make you feel at all. I was driven to study journalism because of my depression. Writing became my way out. I decided I wanted to be a voice for those who are muted by our society. To me, that primarily meant talking about mental illness, racism, and discrimination, and talking about my own experiences openly. And this project has helped me do just that. I know that right now there is a little Hispanic girl in a classroom who is feeling the same things I once did, and she doesn't know what it means or what to do. She doesn't know that it doesn't have to be that way. Depression might not be a word she hears for a while, but it will be something she will secretly suffer with. I want that little girl to learn about depression sooner than I did. I want her to know she is going to be okay. I want her to know she is not alone. I want her to know she is worthy. I want her to know that she should be proud of who she is, of her heritage, and I want her to know that I am rooting for her every day, even if I don't know her name. That's it.
Yeah, wow. It's, you know, incredibly profound.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I feel grateful to have gotten to know Lucero through this project, and gotten to know her much better than I ever knew her in college. So, and I'm grateful for her to have shared her story with us.
Yeah, I can't emphasize that enough. just the gratitude for especially Lucero and others as well. I mean, Dr. Austin, you know, contributed a huge amount of her time, and all the others were just so gracious and kind, and they're taking the time to talk to us and give their perspective. And, you know, Dr. Lorenzo Luasis come back and say, "Thanks for what you're doing, and here are some additional thoughts and some concerns." I mean, just to be gracious enough to provide that feedback and to care enough to step in when he saw a problem. And so, but again, especially with Lucero and Oscar and Rosa, it's just really, it's a big deal. And so I'm incredibly grateful to them for stepping in and doing this. And then I also have to say, I'm incredibly grateful to you, Caroline, for jumping on this project, getting excited about it, and taking the reins, you know, turning in what was a very, very rough, very rough. It wasn't even really an outline. It's just sort of this vague idea, and turning it into something that is as significant as this has been. I'm really grateful to you as well. So.
Well, thank you, David. And thanks for everything you do. And it's been an honor to be a part of this project.
Cool.
Do you want to talk about what's next?
Yeah, we can do that a little bit. We are looking at a whole conversation around end-of-life issues, and I'm really excited about it. I've been talking to some people, reading up on it a little bit. Part of the reason why I'm really interested in it is realizing that we don't give death the treatment that it deserves. We spend so much time preparing for birth appropriately and preparing to live well. Hopefully we prepare to live well, and we do live well, but death is as much a part of life as living is. And we don't usually think about it in those terms. And so I think it's really important to put more attention on that issue, because we're all going to end up dead at some point. And a lot of us, because of where we live and the year in which we live, we're going to end up in a situation that we don't really want, you know, whether that's because of a disease or something else. But a lot of us are going to end up in a hospital, and we or our family members are going to have to make these decisions about what the end of our lives look like. And so I think it's just a really interesting conversation to have around how we prepare for death in the same way that we prepare for life.
Absolutely. I mean, the modern Western medicine has historically been focused on prolonging life as long as possible. And that has been the goal, is to put off death. And so there's a point at which that becomes more harmful to the patient. And I think it's interesting to dive into that tension there.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, excited about that. And we will keep everyone updated. Also should note that you've got some bonus material coming soon about kind of the making of contributing factors. So hopefully that'll get people excited while we're working on season two.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Everyone should stay tuned for our behind the scenes, how we built this episode. And if you want more health further podcast material in the meanwhile, then check out the Future of Health.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Caroline. This is fun.
Yeah, until then. Contributing Factors is written, hosted, and produced by me, Caroline Leland. Our executive producer is David Schifrin. The series' original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. The track can be heard on his upcoming album, so check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor. Michaela Powell provides additional creative assistance. Thanks to Matt Faulkner for not only leading marketing on this series, but also for editorial input throughout the production process. And of course, for participating in that recorded reflection conversation for this episode. Special thanks as always to Lucero Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story. Lucy, we cannot thank you enough for your eloquent vulnerability. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, including the full interviews with everyone you heard today, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors, and while you're there, learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on. You can also find us on Twitter @HealthFurther. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the series. Share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed. So thank you for being here and for helping us spread the word.